From Migration Media, this is Migratory Patterns. I'm your host, Mike Shaw. Richard Robinson isn't a guest on this week's show because of his status as a legend in Chinese entrepreneurial circles. Nor is it because we went to the same high school, though but a decade removed from each other. He's on because he represents a phenomenon among many expats that I've noticed within myself. We grasp onto and amplify the cultural traits that connect us to our places of origin. For myself and Richard, who hasn't lived in Boston since he was 18 years old, this still manifests as a distinct regional accent, a love of local sports teams, and an identification with the gritty and self-important attitudes of our shared hometown. And this core identity endures for him even after years spent doing odd jobs all across Europe, Africa, and Asia, right through his experiences building companies during the dawn of the social media and e-commerce ages in China, through marriage, divorce, remarriage, and raising a family, to mentoring newer entrepreneurs and teaching at a university in Beijing. I really loved this conversation with Richard, as I would say in my local Boston dialect. We always have lots of fun whenever we hang out, mostly because we get to reminisce about our hometown and even our high school. There's something really affirming and grounding about having your core or origin identity shared with and reflected back at you. Even though I'm a confirmed migrant and very happy and comfortable with this new identity, I've been finding that the longer I'm overseas, the more that I cling on to the core elements of the old me. This is something that's been getting stronger within me over the last year, I think because it's getting very real that I am, in fact, going to be living overseas for the foreseeable future. It's something that regular listeners will recognize from recent episodes, and it'll be something that comes up in future conversations as I continue to work through what this means. But that's all in the future. Let's focus on the here and now. Please sit back, relax, and enjoy my conversation with Richard Robinson. Richard Robinson, welcome to Migratory Patterns.
Great to be here, Mike, and great to hear my name pronounced Richard, as we're both from around the city of Boston.
Yeah, our accents might come out, I think.
Yeah, we drop an as. I left my car keys in my car keys.
So, where is home?
Beijing's my home. This week is my 18th anniversary here in the lovely northern capital.
Happy Chinaversary.
Thanks so much. Yeah, 25 years ago, I came here by train, and 22 years ago, I moved to Hong Kong, and I've been here 18 here in Beijing.
We are both from the Boston area. Mm. As again, to listeners, I'll apologize a little bit, but not out of shame, just out of maybe your misunderstanding. Our accents might come out a little bit because my Boston accent really comes out when I'm around other people from the Boston area. Mm. So where are you from originally? Where did you come out of?
I grew up near Tufts University in Medford. So I used to have wicked hash Boston accent, drinking Cutty Sack in the park with an Aardvark and Marky Mark. And funnily enough, Boston, Beijing, same latitude, mm-hmm. opposite ends of the planet. The Boston accent is you pretty much drop the R willy-nilly, right? The Beijing accent, the exact opposite. You add the R where it doesn't even belong, like ping, bottle turns into pier, and Tang Hulu Lai Chuar. So it's kind of this weird time-space continuum where all the ahs and all the socks that you lose in the dryer somehow end up going through the core of the earth.
I love
the jingling.
I always love telling that to Chinese people to introduce. Mm. Like I will always say, you know, Wuxia Dongbei Ren. I'm a Northeasterner because not only have I lived in Northeastern China for a long time, but I'm also a Meiguo de Dongbei Ren. I'm an American Northeasterner. And then I always explain the accent. So they really love that. And I love it too. It's strange. When I first got here, one of the things that happened is something about the way the accent works and how it is, like you said, the exact opposite. And we are on the exact opposite side of the planet. Mm. For some psychological thing happened in my brain and I felt welcome here. Like I felt like I fit here right away.
Me too. Yeah. I feel like there's a grittiness and a
cultural arrogance.
Yeah. The hub. Yeah. That's what Boston used to be called, the hub of the universe. Yeah. But there's a authenticity, I think, to Beijing and to Boston in that maybe it's the weather, maybe it's the sort of, you know, I think of Boston of the 80s, like dirty water, where it definitely wasn't kind of pre-gentrified and a little bit
gritty.
Gritty. There's a grittiness to it. So I was always attracted more to the jingling up here than say Shanghai, which just seemed a little bit more like
New York
or LA or something like that. Right.
Yeah. No, I have the same exact feeling when I just felt when I got here, it was just felt something about the people. Again, that cultural arrogance is kind of a flip way to say it, but there is a real self-importance to the people here and a recognition of their history, which is very familiar coming from a place like Boston.
Yeah. And you talk to maybe a cab driver in Boston and a cab driver in Beijing, and they'll actually have some opinions.
Yeah.
Some more erudite than others, but definitely opinionated.
Yeah. So when you grew up in the Boston area, how did you get from growing up in the Boston area, which is very patrician
Bostonian.
It's very patrician and parochial, you know, how did you get from there to moving overseas?
Yeah, my mother's parents are from Ireland. So like yours, you know, can't spill a pint of Guinness without hitting a plastic patty in Boston for sure. And very much my lens was to the East over to Ireland and the UK, where I had a lot of Irish relatives, and I knew nothing about Asia. Singapore, Sapporo, Shanghai, all the same place to me. I couldn't discern one from the other, but you know, you and I both went to the same high school, right. You know, in like Dorchester, not far from, Southie of, Good Will Hunting fame. And taking the subway out there, it was really pretty rough weather. And I remember it was sleeting under my neck. Like the wind was blowing it somehow up and like stabbing me in the under my chin. And one guy saying, all right, I'm going to go to school in Florida. One guy, I'm going to go to school in Hawaii. And I said, you know what? I'm going to split the difference. I'm going to go to school in California. And then the cuff of my pants was frozen like a bell, like from the slush. When I got to class, you could crack it. And then I thought, you know what? Maybe I will go to school in California. And I talked to a guidance counselor and he's like, I just got this aerial photo of the USC band in the LA Coliseum, spelling out USC. So I apply, you know, as a, you know, lower middle class kid from Boston to a very expensive university with my wicked hash Boston accent, and they give me a full ride. So next thing you know, I'm on a plane out to California with my, you know, dropping as all over the place. And to this day, all my fraternity buddies call me Bosto from Bostonian. So I end up studying at USC, and then they have an exchange program with Cambridge University. So I go and I explore my Irish roots and meet my Irish relatives in the UK and Ireland, and I backpack around Europe and feeling really proud of myself after I study at Cambridge University, 4 weeks on the road, as if I'm some intrepid Indiana Jones-esque.
Boy, you're blazing explorer. A trail no one ever has.
Maybe only 17,000 other people have slept in this youth hostel bed, right? And, you know, the average American takes a 2-week vacation. So I feel like I'm, you know, some guy on like, the back of like a, you know, a dust cover on a book from the 20s who's been like, you know, traveling the world, you know, George Orwell-esque or something. And I meet this Aussie dude and he's like, I don't know, mate, 4 years. And I was like, what? Like literally he unscrewed the top of my skull, took out a soldering iron and just dug a groove in there that he had been on the road for 4 years and I couldn't even process it. And he told me two things. One was he was broke. The other one is he hated flying. So he did it, worked his way around the world and did it all by land. And he said something to me, which was, if you look at the world as a silhouette, a map of the world, there's four swaths of land. There's North South America, there's Europe, Asia, Africa, and Australia. And he said, if you do an overland trip and across those four swaths of land, he said, you can see the world, you can feel the world, but you can also smell it, mate. You can smell the world. And I was like, I want to smell the world. That sounds amazing. So that's what I did is I spent 4 years working my way around the world. I was a
itinerant traveler,
a part of the poverty jet set, right? I mean, the best things in life are free. The next best things are really freaking expensive, right? But like I'm in the south of France and my dad always said, talk to the weirdest or the oldest person whenever you get a chance, right? Because they always have the best stories. So I'm talking to this guy, retired Swiss industrialist. We're watching the sunset on the, you know, Côte d'Azur, both eating some, you know, cheese and bread and a little bit of wine and, you know, looking at the, you know, smelling the salty brine. And it's just amazing, right? And then he said, okay, the sun's getting down. I'm going to go back to my hotel, which was right there on the boardwalk, probably a few hundred euros a night. And I go back and I'm sharing a a youth hostel, you know, with five sets of bunk beds and nine other guys, right? But who cares, right? Because I'm young, I could fall off the top of a building and I could, you know, just brush it off. So I was a bartender in the Virgin Islands. I was a ski bum in Switzerland. I taught English in Prague after the revolution, lived in a fishing village in Norway. I picked grapes in the south of France. I worked at the BMW factory, and that was from like 89 to 90, 93. And then I came here overland. That was my initial impetus. Was
like Marco Polo.
Like Marco Polo indeed, right? Except I wanted to not follow in the footsteps of the intrepid Italian explorer, but that Aussie guy, and do that overland trip. So I thought, all right, this is something that's really kind of like super romantic and sexy, the Trans-Siberian. So I came to Beijing 25 years ago, next week actually, by train. I hitchhiked from Switzerland to Prague, and then Prague, train to Ukraine, Moscow, Siberia, Mongolia, Beijing, all the way to Hong Kong. It was 11 days over a 30-day period.
Pretty soon after the Belt and Road is done, you'll be able to do it in like 20 hours.
Yeah, probably,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
All the high-speed rail in China just puts, you know, Europe to shame, and especially the U.S. And but it was really wonderful. I taken all these books with me, and I thought, I'm going to be bored. And that wasn't the case at all. There was just, you know, it was a lot of birch trees and snow along the way, but it was pretty fascinating to see the gradual change of the, you know, facial features of the people, and the food and the language and the landscape and the architecture. It was just a really fascinating way to do it. So I got into Beijing in 93, mid-December 93, and it was much closer to Mao than to now, right? It was only 17 years after the Cultural Revolution, and that was 25 years ago. And I had very low expectations. You know, I'm 51, so 89 I graduated from college, and the wall had fallen in Berlin. Apartheid ended that year. Winds of change into the future. But then China took three steps backwards on, let's just say, May 35th. And
where nothing happened.
Where nothing happened at all, except some really lovely flowers were exchanged.
Yeah.
Too. Yeah. Thanks for the memories. But anyway, I had very low expectations for modern China. I thought, oh, you know what? Tang Dynasty China. Like, that's fascinating. China was a Peace Corps destination. I was considering the Peace Corps, and like, that's what people could do in China, right? There wasn't really... There's a lot of infrastructure spending, but there's a lot of opportunity for like a young, ambitious guy then, really. So I ended up, rolling in here, and immediately the dragon swooped down and dug her talons into me. And I just smelled, like this Aussie guy said, that this is the biggest story of our life. The rural to urban migration, the increase in GDP per capita, indeed 25x since the Cultural Revolution, and 800 million people pulled out of poverty. Like, you know, there's a billion people in Africa and a billion people in India, but they're not going to go in the same trajectory that China has in the last 30 years. So I just knew I wanted to have a front row seat at the show. And I traveled around the rest of Asia, but nothing grabbed me by the lapels and slapped me silly like this place. It chose me. I had like no choice in it at all. So I got my MBA right after that in the Netherlands. I wanted an international MBA, and I felt that any program in the U.S. was very American-centric, and there was no real options for Asia-based MBAs in the mid-90s. So I looked at European ones, and I applied to Erasmus University and, you know, looked at programs in the U.K. and, you know, France. But I chose Erasmus in Rotterdam because I just felt it was very agnostically international. And I fell in love with the internet. August of 94, I worked in the library, and I took my first ride on the consumer web, Mosaic, the predecessor of Netscape. So I thought, okay, another epiphany that I just don't have any choice over. I love the internet. I love China. Let's do internet in China. And 95, I spent my summer between Hong Kong and Amsterdam doing a summer internship, and I realized good buddy from my ski bum days in Switzerland, living in Hong Kong. And Woody Allen says 80% of success is just showing up. So I knew that from experience. You just kind of put your flag in the sand. And as Paulo Coelho of The Alchemist says, you know, you make a decision and the universe conspires to help you achieve that goal. So I knew that I could just show up on his doorstep, you know, darken his doorstep and towels for a few weeks until I found a job. So graduated in 96, no job, very little money, lots of student loans. So I got a one-way ticket to Africa. So I thought, all right, this is my chance to screw around and avoid getting a real job and do that other overland trip that that Aussie guy talked about. And I rode a bicycle through Africa for 4 months, kind of a last crazy adventure before jumping into my
real
entrepreneurial pursuits. Yeah. And it was exhilarating and boring and reckless and all of the above. It was sort of like entrepreneurship, I guess you could say. And I did 5,000 kilometers from Nairobi to Cape Town.
You're the second person I've talked to in a couple few weeks that has done the kind of overland trek across Africa thing.
Mm.
Yeah.
I highly recommend it. Yeah. I mean, most people do it by truck because there's not, or maybe motorcycle. There's not, you know, or maybe China, investment will change that, but there's not a lot of rail, in Africa. But, it was definitely a character building, you know, pretty amazing adventure. And, you know, Forrest Gump talks about how, you know, when he's running, he just retains all these good memories. And I think indeed, like, if you look at like life on sort of a baseline level, like we don't really stray that far from the baseline, like once in a while, a high or a low, but doing travel or entrepreneurship, it really pushes one to the extremes of both the highs and the lows much more frequently. And so I think that kind of travel, seat of the pants, almost reckless, but hopefully not dangerous. Very uncomfortable at times and amazingly just intoxicatingly terrific at others. Like the beautiful part is all the bad stuff in the bottom kind of fades away, and then you get to retain all that cream on the top, and you get to sort of push the gauges to the edge there. So in some ways, people ask me like, how can I be an entrepreneur? And like, I think it's good working in a startup or just being an entrepreneur, just trying a venture. But I think also getting comfortable with discomfort is something that I think is an important
traveling the world the way you do will help you do that.
Yeah. When you're just like, hey, I woke up and I'm still here. Right. And like, yeah, maybe I haven't eaten well, or maybe I'm covered with a few different infections and a whole bunch of different bites and I'm sunburned and I don't know where I'm going to sleep tonight, but I'm living life I'm at sort of edge of my humanity, which is how I feel with entrepreneurship sometimes. But yeah, so then I wrapped up that trip, and then that was August of 96. And then I moved here in December of 96, and I spent 4 years in Hong Kong and 18 here in Beijing. And I've been part of, you know, I've been a startup guy. I've been part of 8 startups, three as a executive in private companies that went public. And I started 5 companies, exited 3 to publicly listed companies. Number 4 was a mercy kill. Number 5, still kind of limping along.
When you start getting into those numbers, it's kind of in the intervention period. Like someone needs to sit you down. Like you need to get your loved ones together and have a round discussion.
I'm a glutton for punishment. You're absolutely right. The default setting for startups is failure. And I don't mean just failure, but like absolute, all-encompassing, magnificent failure. And it's mostly kind of sucks along the way, right? And it doesn't even really get that much better. But other than that, Mrs. Lincoln, how did you enjoy the play?
Right.
So,
well, you know,
to keep doing it is, yeah.
You're well known in circles around here and throughout
Asia. For being a chump?
For being a total chump that just dives into these crazy harebrained schemes that.
I'm so crazy. I don't know. This is impossible.
Well, you know, entrepreneurship is interesting. And I like the way that you, you know, identify what you do now and kind of relate it to how you got to where you are. And I mean that physically, geographically. Mm. When I want to back up just a little bit, because the kind of the story you told, and I've heard it before, and you're, it's a well-known story because you talk about it a lot. It sounds to me like that whole migration life is something you kind of fell into. Like you said, oh, it's snowy, so I'll try California. And oh, I have Irish heritage, I'll go check that out. And oh, I'm in Europe, and what's this all about? And it's kind of like the slippery slope.
It was a gateway drug.
I was going to say, going to California was like the total gateway drug for, and now you're living this migrant life that has been actually migratory, and now you've kind of settled in quotation marks. How did you kind of know that was happening to you while it was happening to you? Were you thinking about maybe, okay, I'll take this step and then I'll go back to Boston, or I'll take this step and then I'll go back to wherever? Was that part of your mindset, or did you not really think that way?
Yeah. You know, I didn't have that much of a plan, but I think my big turning point was when I went to Prague, and I was in Prague after the revolution, and there was this electricity, this sense of anything is possible. I remember just being there before I moved there, one guy selling like Glühwein, like hot wine, on the side of the street, and he's like, first we make revolution, then we make love, now we make money, right? And I just thought, like, wow.
That's
like
the best propaganda poster ever.
I usually see like a sickle and a book and a weapon, but I think you'd see three other things featured there. But that's a whole nother story. But the ability to go, you know, like when you're most of Europe that I found was less exciting than the U.S. because it was so old school. It was. Okay, especially Switzerland, which I loved. It was like God's giant train set. Everything was so perfectly done.
And coming from New England, we kind of have this, like, we're familiar with that aesthetic. It's obviously not as deep-seated because we're quote, only 400 years old right there. But I mean, I remember when I was in London for the Olympics, we did my ex and I, we did a train trip across Europe heading towards London for the Olympics. And when we stayed in not even suburban London, we stayed like an hour outside the city on the train. And I remember we were in this village, quote, village, and the streets, the street names, the houses, the way the town was set up, I was like, oh my God, this is New England. Like, and then it dawned on me, like, of course, because New England was settled by the English, and they designed it to look exactly like this. I was like, oh, I get this now. Like, I understand where I come from and what that means, because where I come from came from someplace else. And I started to recognize that. So like, it's interesting that you note that Europe was kind of boring in the sense that it's very similar to what we have. And like, of course it is, because it came from there.
I think partially because it's knowable. And also just because it's just more established, right?
Yeah.
There was like,
it's developed.
You know, it's developed. And especially like some of these Germanic, you know, countries where it's like, okay, the banks close during lunch. And then they close at 4, and you're just like, well, how are you supposed to go to the bank, right? And just like, there wasn't this sense of drive and possibility. There's a sense of like, all right, everything is already kind of mostly optimized, and there's high taxes here, and there's not a lot of entrepreneurialism, and there's a lot of charm and beauty and nice lifestyle here, but it doesn't feel like anything's possible. It felt more restrictive than the U.S. and you know, palpably and rightfully so, right? Like, not just like quantitatively. And then to experience that in Eastern Europe, in Prague, I was like, oh, you know what? I like this sense, this chaos. I like this sort of low base, where everything is possible, and it's just, it's not that comfortable, and it's not that predictable, but man, you can pretty much do anything. So I always thought, like, you know what, I'm going to go back. I'm going to go back to Eastern Europe, and like, that's where my jam is. And then I got here, and I was like, holy what? Like, the dragon swooped down and dug her talons into me. And then she and I had two kids together, and now we're amicably divorced. But I still love, thank you, good night. I still, like, this place, it doesn't, like, I often say, everything is possible, nothing is easy. And that's why I still love it here, is that dynamism and that sense of possibility. And it's definitely not optimizing for lifestyle or for comfort or for ease of getting things done, right? I guess I could go to like, I don't even know. I've never been to Brazil. Like, I'm sure there's like really nice lifestyle there, or I could go San Diego, or I could go, you know, somewhere in Switzerland or something, right? Where nice like stability and predictability and, you know, nice weather or nice, you know, or just whatever kind of like ease of lifestyle. Like here, there's a lot of sacrifices, but I'm a very willing guest because let's face it, I am a guest. They don't have to allow me to be here, and nor do I need to necessarily live here. I really choose and want to live here, right? But it's, you know, the traffic and the pollution, even though today is fit for human habitation, right? And the just sort of cultural challenges and the it's a low trust society. I mean, that's not anything judgmental, right? I mean, something like Switzerland or Norway or Japan are pretty high trust societies, and you know, America might be somewhere in the middle, depending where you are, what part of the country you're in. But here, you know, it's very clearly a low trust society. It's just sort of the way it is. Therefore, you kind of have to be more measured in your approach and kind of watch your back and do things in a way that may have a little bit more friction. But if you're able to build up relationships and build up enough cultural understanding and language skills, and then this place is pretty intoxicatingly attractive.
Attractions aside, you've invested a lot of effort in, you know, after you kind of were ambling around and felt the energy and the buzz and the call and everything, once you're drawn to a place, you were drawn to the place, you've at this point invested a lot. You've put down roots and not just building businesses or connections or emotional support systems. I mean,
or building this courtyard house that we're sitting in.
Yeah, this house, you know, you've built a family. So
a couple of families.
Yeah, a couple of families. You're like an entrepreneur. So the notion of, quote, going home wouldn't even really apply to you, because your home is where you've made it, really. I mean, in theory, from what I'm kind of getting from you, is you could go establish yourself someplace else. It's almost like you've got your family, and wherever they are is where your home will be. And it's not about going to any particular place anymore, because you spent so much time moving around. And I think about this because a lot of people I talk to are, let's just say, less advanced age than you are. You know, you're not over the hill by any stretch, but you know,
I'm on the wrong side of 50.
Well, you know, people younger and more at the start of their careers than in the middle of them. And the idea of kind of going on an adventure or having this pathway in front of you, and we can go wherever, it's a slightly different perspective for you. So I'm wondering how you think about next steps, or if you're in one place and you're going to move to another, what does that look like? And there is no, quote, going back for you. There's really only going forward, right?
Sure. So, you know, I do enjoy going back to North America, and we do that every summer, and I do that a few times a year.
You still have family there.
Still have, you know, a small Irish family with 30 cousins back in the city of Boston, right? And all their spouses and kids and mom and my sis and her three kids. So I definitely have the roots back there, and the kids have a summer home up in Lake District in New Hampshire. So that's, you know, so that's nice. So they have the roots back there. But I do see that I can't necessarily go back to North America. My wife doesn't want to go back to North America. She's Canadian. She doesn't want to go to Canada, and I don't necessarily want to go back to the States. So we talk about going someplace warm. Boys are 14 and 12, and we have a little 3-year-old girl. And when the 12-year-old goes off to gap year or university or penitentiary, and I love you, in 5 years, then we'll probably go someplace warm. But that would probably mean Shenzhen. It could mean something like Phuket.
Bali,
maybe one of the islands in Indonesia, maybe Malaysia, maybe who knows. You know, we also talk about having this sort of nomadic lifestyle, maybe going and living someplace for a year and enjoying that, and then coming, you know, coming back to Asia. Maybe we go to Buenos Aires, or maybe we go to Barcelona, or maybe we go to you know, some, who knows, Cape Town or something. But, you know, that's a possibility in the next 5 years. But most likely we're going to be around Asia. 60% of the world's population is here in the Asian continent, but probably 80% of the dynamism and possibility is here. So we've built our entire careers around that. I think we'll stay in Asia, but maybe we just have to be less dependent upon one location. You kind of move around a little bit more.
So that's really, I'm wondering what kind of conversations you have with that teeny tiny Irish family back in the Boston area when, you know, your thought process is about where to go next and where you might end up next. And it doesn't really include where you're from. How does that affect your relationships with people back home where you came from?
Well, first of all, I think in the past few years, they stopped asking, like, Richard, when are you coming back
home? Did that only take 20 some odd years?
Are you going to come back? And like,
because I'm in year 10.
My aunt, after I'm in year 22, and like year 16, we're in a shopping mall together, and she sees somebody she knows, and she's like, let me introduce you to my nephew, Richard. He lives in Tokyo. And they're like, how's your Japanese? And I was like, it's not, my Japanese is not really very good, but it's okay. Cause they just, I've had two, my mom and dad came to visit, and my one cousin came to visit.
No one really comes, huh?
That's it.
Yeah.
Right.
That's something it's common. Just, people just don't come.
And then, you know, I just saw a fascinating, fascinating documentary by Peter Jackson from the Lord of the Rings. And it's called They Will Not Grow Old.
That's the great World War One.
World War One. He colorizes and he changes the frame rate. So, and then he even adds sound effects in the background and voiceovers to really humanize that footage, which is very, you know, jittery. And he takes through the whole process of World War One and the trench warfare. But then, like, one guy's like, the very last scene of the movie, it's a spoiler alert. This guy go back to work at a supermarket after being in the trenches, miserable trenches for 4 years. And he said, this is the only time anybody annoyed me. One guy walked up to me and he goes, oh, hey, Martin, how you been? Have you been working nights? I haven't seen you for a while.
Oh.
like nobody wanted to talk about the war after it was over. And like, as an expat, people know, like, nobody wants to talk about your life here because they have nothing. There's just no context, right? And they just have no idea at all. So I don't even try at all, right? It's just back to like, hey, how's the Pats? And like, oh my God, can you believe Trump? And oh my God, can you believe this, you know, the big dig, right? It's leaking so much. I drove through the tunnel with my trunk open and I caught 6 fish, right? And like, they should charge $6 to drive through the big dig tunnel and just put a sign in the front that says cow wash. And then anyway... But like, that's all people care about is like local stuff. And like, you know, it's just kind of the way it is. So people not only, you know, people don't really stop asking me. And it's okay. It's okay with me.
I have, I've talked about this on the show a few times when one of my closest friends from college, you know, after I moved here, we had a conversation and he talked about how he was having conversations with our circle of friends, and he kind of told them, he's like, guys, he's not coming back. Like, he's just not, like, they all thought that I would maybe quit living overseas after a year and, you know, 6 months or a year. And he said, he's not coming back. And I think there's something that happens when you move overseas and you've realized, I mean, you had that moment kind of, I think, when you talked about when you were in Prague, where it kind of clicked for you that like, oh, this is where I want to be. This is where I need to make my stand. And for me, it happened very quickly after I moved here. Like there was just this realization that, oh, outside, I don't think it was China per se. I think China maybe brought it out quicker than it would have come out anywhere else. But as soon as I was outside of my context, as soon as I was outside of America for enough time and kind of the stuff that you carry around with you when you're living at home and you don't realize
that angry soil of Boston, right?
Well, I think it's the, you know, you live in, I don't want to say a box, but it's, you have a framework that you're living in. You're like, this is how you get a career. This is where you go to school. This is how your life is supposed to progress. Here are the stages. Here are the things you need to achieve along the way. And when all that gets thrown out the window, because you're in a place where none of that exists, there are no expectations. No one knows who you are, where you come from.
Like, oh, it's all an illusion.
Exactly.
It's like, all an illusion.
Oh, you mean I really can do anything I want? And by anything, you mean anything.
Sure.
You know, when, once you kind of get that taste, if that hits you, I really feel like that, you know, that's when the bug and you realize there is no
coloring going back. Is in the swimming pool and you can't take it out.
Yeah.
I read this great book recently, Principles by Ray Dalio. If you have a chance to read it, great. If you don't, he has a 30-minute animated video that he's put together. He's really put a lot of time and money and energy into doing this 30-minute video. And he talks about how you really have to look at your values, like what you truly value. And then you should really pursue crafting a life around those values. Like, you know, you ask about, well, how does my family relate? Like my brother-in-law, love the guy. I absolutely love the guy. He's built a beautiful, like true American dream with my sister up in, you know, rural New Hampshire. And he's been in the same company for 33 years as an engineer. And he's really providing for the family and everybody is super taken care of and happy and challenged or whatever. But he looks like he doesn't even pull any punches. He's just like, I tell him something and he's like, oh my God, what a nightmare. Oh my God, did you hear about riches? That's what a nightmare that is, right? But I'm not telling the story as if I want some sympathy. I'm just like, oh, so this happened. And he's, oh my God, that's nightmarish, right? So as far as he's concerned, like my life is a nightmare.
There's this endless travail of
like, why would you live there and doing that? And like the Cheesecake Factory and like, you know, being able to get like football games and just like the hassles and what? Like, how that's so inconceivable that you're just making your life like an endless series of just pains in the asses, right? And I don't think of his life as nightmarish, not by any means, but I would not want to choose that, right? Like, it's just a different. We have to have different values, right?
Or just a different way that you find, you know, you don't really see it as a challenge or a bad thing that there are challenges. You just, that's just fine for you. That's you can exist and be happy in that context. Fine.
I guess what I found is that because people usually live life, as I mentioned before, I mean, you have to really visualize it as like this one baseline and then this sort of EKG, like along that baseline, right? Up, down, up, down, up, down, maybe kind of flat. Once in a while, woohoo! And once in a while, ooh, right? But most of the time, like within that flat baseline. And then once you get pushed out of that flat baseline and you get pushed way down, but then you also get pushed way up high through travel or through some sort of intercultural milestone, you know, that kind of typical classic U curve, right? You're on the left side of the letter U and you're like, oh my God, look at me. I'm like in China and this is great. And wow, even look at those drains. Those drains are different from the States. And like, oh, look at the smell that and like see that. And then you go down the letter U all the way to the bottom where you're like, oh my God, like I don't know anybody here. And like those drains are horrible. They smell terrible. And like, why can't people just do things the way that I do it? And then finally, after realizing that, like when I'm driving a car, it's like, you know what? Like I'm not going to like one person at a time, teach people how to drive my way. Like as if my way is the better way. I'm going to basically one person at a time is going to teach me that I need to adjust to how everybody else is driving here. And then, you know, then you're back up to the right side of the U. So you go through that U curve. So I realize that if I want to go to those higher highs, I have to go to those lower lows. So I embrace those. And I actually really look at that as like, every problem that you have is an opportunity for you to get stronger. Right. And I think oftentimes like one of the things that I love so many things about back home, but one of the things I don't really love is that somehow people equate, especially my age on the wrong side of 50, like, oh, I have worked this long and hard, you know, three decades out of college, and therefore I must never be uncomfortable. I need to be able to pamper myself in a way that makes it so that I'm not, you know, my health is compromised, or my ability to be able to have any capacity for dealing with new challenges is reduced. And, you know, I basically stopped learning. Right. And I think that's a insidious result of maybe being in a place where the GDP per capita or the standard of living is too high, that you just sort of become like a frog slowly boiled in water. And then you're not really being the best version of yourself, because you're not challenging yourself enough. So
I actually have this whole diatribe I could go on about people who live outside their country actually being probably the best observers of, you know, national politics and things, because you can see what's happening from the outside, where the people inside maybe, you know, these little things happen and happen and happen, and you don't know the changes that are taking place because you're soaking in it. Mm. But if you're outside it and your reference is kind of incremental or periodic, as you glance back or as you refer back to kind of your cultural touchstones, or you turn, you know, you're living over here, but then you turn your head to look back and, oh my God, what's that change that happened? Well, you notice it because you're outside, but the people inside, maybe they don't see the big turn that they've done, because they're soaking in it. Right. So I actually think that there's great value in people who live outside the place where they came from originally, either adding their voice to what's happening back there, or going back and starting a business. Like, entrepreneurism is your niche, your baby. And I've had more than a couple of ideas for businesses, and I've talked to people. Stuff hasn't really gone anywhere, but because I've kind of fallen on the migration media is the thing I want to do. But I've had ideas for businesses to go back and how can I take what I'm learning here? How can I help people back home, or, you know, back where I came from? Plug into what's going on here. Like, a lot of it is about, there's so much amazing stuff that I see that I know they don't, that they can't, not because they're blind or, you know, it's not smart enough, but just because they're not looking here. You know, I'm here. Let me show this to you. And I think about that a lot, that outside perspective. How can we keep, or how do we honor where we came from, even if we don't want to go back there? You know, what are the ways we can do that? And, you know, you said you bring your kids back there every summer, and kind of that gets into identity and who are they growing up, and are they Bostonians?
We watched Good Will Hunting together. that was great. Yeah, I mean, they're definitely not Bostonians, right? They don't have the accent. They make fun of me.
Let me just say, you're a poor parent. You're a failure. I didn't see any Red Sox hats on them when I came in.
They have Red Sox hats. They don't like to wear hats at all, right? They have a whole stack of them. And then the Sox win again for the third time in 12 years, 14 years. And, you know, they won zero times for 86 years. And they were like, oh, they won again? That's nice. And I'm like, you don't know. You don't know, right?
You don't understand, you damn
that
kids.
Bitterness that I grew up
and
with.
You can't even call them pink hats because they don't have any hats.
Yes. They actually have a green hat, which is funny because there's a whole another meaning in Chinese, China, the Lusa, the Malza, but I mean, it is a little bit, you know, like they do get it though. They do know Boston, and they can, you know, make fun of the Boston accent, and they can, you know, they know kind of their way around there, but they're not. And I don't even know if they're necessarily really hardcore Beijingers either, because they're like, they live out in the suburbs now. Right. And it's like, they've become these suburban kids out near Shunyi. Right. And like, you know,
yeah, the suburb kids. Yeah. And being someone who lives in the city center, when you say I'm going out to Shunyi, everyone just rolls their eyes like,
there be dragons.
Yeah. Well, you know, this is a kind of a question that I'm just starting to deal with, because I mean, I've been out here for 10 years, so I should have been dealing with it more, but prospects, because of my wife's career, is we're going to be out here probably for the foreseeable future. And I'm starting to think about, well, I always knew I wasn't, quote, going back, but I was it's never been kind of put in my face with, you're actually going to be out here for a while. And what does my identity mean to me as I continue to stay out here? You know what I mean? Like, I'm fiercely proud of, like you, where I am, mm-hmm. all that cultural mm-hmm. ephemera that is infused in me that I mm-hmm. advertise to everyone through my clothing and my crazy accent. But how does that stay with me? How do I honor it? How do I let it, you know, how do I continually affirm it with everything I do? Like, that's going to be the challenge for me, mm. you know?
Yeah, so I've grabbed a new tribe. Like, I, of course, am a ugly American to the bone, and I can't shake that. And I'm proud of being from being a masshole here in, you know, abroad. But I guess it really is pretty loose, because I've actually spent more time outside, 22 in China and 5 years in Europe, and then another year traveling, and then 4 years in California, right? So the vast majority of my life and almost my entire adult life has been outside of that. So for me, my tribe is around entrepreneurship. So those are the people that I spend most time with, and who you know, whether local Chinese or Europeans or, you know, fellow massholes or Americans, it doesn't, you know, that's my sort of identity in a way, right? I think the internet is great for that, but it's also it can be an insidious thing too, where you just get into this echo chamber of just hanging out with people from that sort of cohort or identity or tribe or whatever, and then kind of closes off to other things. But I think you and I are both not shy wallflowers and also curious, so that we end up meeting a lot of, you know, different people and kind of connecting those people together. So I think in some ways I'm a really entrepreneur and I love entrepreneurship, but in other ways, if I really have to think about, like, my wife asked me, like, you know, like, what's your purpose in life? She does women's leadership development and really helps people kind of like be their true authentic self. And I think for me, if I really have to narrow it down, and it may sound a little cheesy, but it's actually something really true. It's like, personal brand is as a connector. Like, I just love putting people together. So, you know, I've been a user of LinkedIn from the very beginning. I have 17,000 plus connections there. And I so enjoy, you know, I speak at a lot of conferences, so I meet a lot of people through there. Meeting somebody and saying, oh, you know, I really want to do this partnership, or I want to hire somebody, or I need to get this, you know, sort of exposure in the press, or I need to, you know, raise money, and to be able, for fun and profit sometimes, to be able to connect those people together. That's what I really enjoy doing. So I really think about things on a sort of global level, and also where there's just a lot of unmet needs. And it's such a pleasure and honor to just put those as yet ignited, you know, sort of kindling together and create that spark. It's, you know, that's what I love.
Well, I'm going to wish you best of luck on your next 6 or 7 businesses. I hope none of them fail too terribly and awfully. And I appreciate you taking the time today. Thanks so much.
Mikey Shaw from Dorchester, everybody. Wicked Pisser. Thank you.
Well, there you have it. Another great conversation. Thanks so much to Richard Robinson for coming on. I learned a lot. I hope you all did too. If you have any questions or comments or feedback about the conversations, please do get in touch. You can reach me at mike.shaw@migrationmedia.net. I'm also on Twitter at @ZAX2000. Thanks to everyone who's been touching base. Really do appreciate the feedback. If you can, take a moment to give us a like and a rating and maybe a review on Apple Podcasts or any podcast you're listening to. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you next week.